Hello, everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Wednesday. And I must say, I've been really lucking out on these Wednesdays. Every week seems to be nice. I remember only one rainy Wednesday, I think, this whole summer. So I'm really glad to be here with all of you. I have a great new recipe to share with all of you. And I wanted to talk to you about some of the things going on in our wonderful New York area. And also encourage all of you who live in other areas to find out what's going on in your areas. A lot of the organizations that I partner with and look up to are national organizations or international organizations, so you can find chapters in your local area. One of my favorite organizations, one that I am a chapter leader of, is Slow Food. And, of course, we have Slow Food USA and there's International Slow Food. And it is just a wonderful organization, really trying to raise awareness about our local food system and about the things that we can do to improve our food and the rights of everybody to good, clean, and fair food, both in access and in quality. And it's a right that everyone should be able to get good food. And so that Slow Food is a wonderful organization. And no matter where you live in this country, I think you should be able to find a chapter near you. And if you can't, then I recommend you trying to start one. So you can check out Slow Food USA's website. And if you live in the area, you can check out Slow Food Huntington's website and see some of the things that we're involved in. This has been a great week. I actually came back from 5 days on the Cape, and it was a really wonderful, relaxing time. You could see dolphins off of the coast and right at the beach, see the dolphins. And, of course, we knew that the sharks were not far away. So I wasn't that big into the water this week. But it was wonderful to refresh and to cool off in the water. And then just being on the beach, hearing the surf and watching children build sandcastles, it was just really a pleasure. I hadn't been to the beach in a long time, especially, you know, days at a time. And so it was really a treat. Tomorrow is my third cooking class of my series this August. Tomorrow's class is a vegetarian cooking class. So the first one was a vegan class. The second one was a raw class. Tomorrow's is a vegetarian class. And all that means is it's vegetarian food. It does include some dairy, but most of the dairy is like a sprinkle of goat cheese on your vegan salad, so you can choose to not use the dairy if you don't want to. None of the recipes that I'm doing are really dairy-based. But as we all know, eating a vegetarian diet is certainly the healthier way to go, and plant-based food is the best for all of us and for the environment. So if you are available, there's still some space in tomorrow night's class, and I have a really exciting menu planned, and I'd love to see some of you there. What else is going on in the city? There was a great fracking demonstration today outside of the Sheraton Hotel, trying to let Governor Cuomo know that we do not want fracking in New York State. We've already seen the devastation it's had in Pennsylvania and some other areas in the country. And fracking is not good for anybody except the corporations that stand to make big profits from it. So let's keep fracking out of New York State. For those of you that do not know what fracking is the process of where they pump thousands of pounds of toxic chemicals into the shale rock to extract gas that they then let escape into the atmosphere and into the water. They are able to capture some of it, but not all of it, and it's really just bad news. And it devastates the small towns where they go in and do this. So people who had nice, quiet country lives all of a sudden have trucks and large equipment coming in on these small little roads and digging up their backyards, and it's really bad news. So if you hear about fracking, please stand in solidarity with those of us that are boycotting it and trying to raise awareness about keeping it away. There are a couple things going on in the city that I'd like to share with you. On August 25th, there is a workshop at the Third Ward, which is a new community space in Brooklyn. And this is about urban food waste and talks about composting and composting in the city and how we can compost and get it into the gardens. And that's a really great, important workshop. And you can go to the Third Ward website for more information on that. There's the Food System Network's annual Tomato Fest and Tomato Uncook-Off, and that's August 26th from 12 to 4, taking place at the New Amsterdam Market in Brooklyn. Slow Food New York City and Wholesome Wave are partnering for a week-long of, it's almost like another restaurant week, but lots of restaurants are participating, celebrity chef poetry slam and benefit performance. Lots of stuff going on over 7 days, 25 different restaurants participating. So go to the Slow Food New York City website or the Wholesome Wave website to find out more information about that. Also on September 1st on Governor's Island, there's something called Pig Island, which is just an end of the summer event. They invite lots of local farmers, chefs, brewers, and vintners to bring the best of New York City to Governor's Island, and all proceeds benefit the Food Systems Network and City Harvest. So think about going to that. If you're up for making a trip to Hershey Park, Pennsylvania, the Farm Aid concert, Farm Aid 2012, is happening at Hershey Park this year. And I went to the concert a few years ago on Randall's Island, and it was just so great. And of course, you know, Willie Nelson has been involved in the Farm Aid for years, and Dave Matthews is always there, and Mellencamp is there, and oh, there's a whole list of who else? Neil Young will be there, John Mellencamp, Kenny Chesney, Jack Johnson, and lots more. Tim Reynolds. So anyway, check that out if you're interested in going to the Farm Aid concert. It benefits local farmers. And as you know, many of you know, we need our farmers. And the majority of people who visit farmers markets know that most farmers these days are over 55 and are nearing retirement. And getting into farming is a really difficult profession for youngsters today. The cost of land is enormous. Getting started with equipment is enormous, and it's just not made easy. And there are some programs that are making it a little easier for young people to get involved in farming. But we really need to support our farmers. Speaking of which, I have a young farmer who will be my guest today on the show. Her name's Gwen Chance, and she is an urban farmer at the Brooklyn Grange. And in a little bit, I'll tell you more about that. Before she joins us. I also want you to save the date for the New York Coalition of Healthy School Food. They are having their annual fundraiser on October 10th, and that takes place at the New York Academy of Medicine. I've been partnering with the New York Coalition of Healthy School Food for a bunch of years now. They're a wonderful organization trying to promote plant-based food into all of the schools in New York, and they have a lot of great programs. They have, you know, a waking up in the morning program where schools can sign up for little sound bites over the PA system about healthy eating. They have programs going on in Harlem and other parts of the state promoting plant-based foods, and they've been really instrumental in getting more plant-based options into New York City schools. So this benefit will be benefiting them. I will be there stir-frying some delicious stir-fry vegetables with rice noodles, a gluten-free dish that we know that we cover our gluten-free friends there. And if you can make it, love to see you there. Just Food is also having their annual fundraiser. That is on October 3rd, and that's at the Altman Building. It's from 6 to 10 at night, and that benefits all the work that Just Food does, which is another wonderful, great organization in New York City, bringing farmers markets and urban gardens to much needed areas within our city limits. So if you are available October 3rd, come out for that. And there's a big event that goes on every year up in Binghamton called Growing Health 2012. That's on October 16th at the Riverwalk Hotel in Binghamton. And that's another whole huge wellness event if you're interested in that. So what else? Oh, this is really funny in the news this week. You know, there's a whole bunch of moms heading down to Washington, D.C., to boycott, to boycott the laws that are trying to regulate both raw milk and lemonade stands. And I just read this and I couldn't help but laughing. I mean, it's funny that at this time, you know, with all the regulations that are going on, that our government is really trying to stop lemonade stands. I mean, kids selling lemonade. And of course, you know, most of the lemonade that most kids are selling at their lemonade stands happens to be pretty crappy. It's, you know, not many of them are squeezing their own lemons. But come on, people. We have to, you know what our boundaries are. Little kids should be able to have a lemonade stand at the end of their driveway and not have to worry about the police closing them down. We have definitely much bigger problems to deal with, and we should let the lemonade stands continue. And if somebody wants to buy raw milk directly from a farmer who has a cow, they should be allowed to do that too. We need to, you know, prioritize where we're putting our energies and allow people to make their own healthy choices. So on that note, I'd like to share with you a delicious recipe that I created this Monday, actually. I had a party here on Sunday for my husband's company picnic, and we had like 10 ears of corn left over, and I was just like, okay, what am I going to do with this? Like, of course, I can make a corn salad, but I thought corn chowder would be really great. And, you know, I love corn chowder, but I rarely eat it because it's usually a cream base, and very often they put bacon in it, and it's hard to get a hearty corn chowder that I want to eat. So, this one is just great. So this is what you need. Start with 10 ears of leftover corn. So when you're making corn, next time boiling it up, you know, try to plan on 10 extra ears. One large sweet onion, 1 tablespoon of chopped garlic, 1 cup of chopped celery, 1 cup of chopped carrots, 1 cup of chopped red pepper. And the reason I'm giving you quantities that are already chopped is because this is also one of the reasons I also made this is I had so much crudité left over. So I already had cut up carrots and cut up peppers, so I just had to chop them up a little bit more. So I measured everything out for you. So these are real measurements, a cup of chopped red pepper. But that does not mean that you couldn't put more of anything in. If you have extras or you have something else left over that I didn't put in, feel free. I always say this, as the chef, you're the creator and you can do what you want. You need some olive oil for sautéing. I use 12 small potatoes in this recipe. Obviously, if you have large potatoes, just cut it in half and use 6 larger potatoes. 2 tablespoons chopped parsley, 1 can of coconut milk, 2 tablespoons flour, 2 tablespoons of coconut oil, 3 teaspoons salt, 1/2 teaspoon white pepper, 1/2 teaspoon nutmeg, 1/2 teaspoon red pepper, croutons if you'd like for garnish, and chopped parsley also for garnish. And I use parsley, but if you like cilantro, cilantro would be great in this recipe instead or in addition to. But again, so many people don't like cilantro, I'm hesitant to use that exclusively. Okay, so to start, I removed the corn from the cobs, and then I boiled the cobs in 20 cups of filtered water. And I put 2 teaspoons of salt into the water along with 1 bay leaf. And then I reserved the corn kernels for sautéing in a little while. Then I added the potatoes to the pot and simmered them for 20 minutes. And the idea here is really to get the potatoes soft and to get all the flavoring out of what's remaining in the cobs. Meanwhile, I sautéed the onion in a heavy cast iron skillet for about 5 minutes. Then I added the celery, the garlic, and the carrots, and I cooked for another 5 minutes. Then I added the pepper, and I cooked for another 5 minutes. Again, the idea here is when you're starting with root vegetables, you always put the root vegetables in first because they take longer to cook, and then you add the other things. So if you're adding any broccoli or anything like that, you'd add it around the same time that you're adding the peppers or the carrots. You know, they take a little bit longer. It takes a little longer than the peppers to cook, but not as long as the onions. Okay? After you have all your vegetables sautéing, you can add the corn kernels and sauté those for another 5 minutes. When all that is sautéed, you can just turn the heat off. You're going to remove the corn cobs and the bay leaf from the soup pot. And then you want to puree half of the potatoes in there. Now, pureeing the potatoes is going to help make this soup a cream soup without using any dairy. But I didn't want to puree all of them. So I used an immersion blender, which is just a stick blender that I could just stick right into the pot, and I pureed some of the potatoes, but not all of them. If you don't have an immersion blender, you can strain out a couple cups worth of the potatoes and puree that and then put it back in. Either way works just fine. Then I added the sautéed veggies to the soup. I added the remaining teaspoon of salt, the pepper, the nutmeg, and the red pepper flakes. Now, the red pepper flakes did give it a little bit of a spice, a little kick to it. If you don't want that, you can leave that out, and it still will be delicious. So I use the same sauté pan. If you don't know me by now, you know that I'm really into trying to limit how many pots and pans I use. I don't have a dishwasher following behind me like I have when I work in restaurants. So I use the same pan. I just wiped out any remaining vegetables that were in the cast iron pan. I used the same pan for making this roux. And instead of butter, I used coconut oil. And I used, for every tablespoon of the fat, you want a tablespoon of flour. So I used 2 tablespoons of coconut oil. So I added 2 tablespoons of unbleached white flour. And if you need it to be gluten-free, you can certainly use gluten-free flour in here. I substituted that many times in soups, and it works just fine. Once you make the roux, you're whisking the flour in with the oil. Once you have a paste, you add the coconut milk to the roux, whisking constantly until blended. You want to be careful not to let any lumps form. And then I added some of the soup broth to this mixture and kept whisking it to prevent any lumps. And then I added that mixture back into the soup. And then I cooked for about 30 more minutes, allowing it to thicken. Keep stirring, being careful not to let it stick to the bottom, and that is it. Super simple, easy, and very flexible with what you have lying around your kitchen. So enjoy, and let me know how it is. I love feedback. I have a new website, by the way, I want to share with all of you. So go to www.iegreen, and iegreen.com, sorry, and you will see my new website up, and I am starting a blog. So lots of new things happening. So there's places for you to comment all over the new website. So I hope to hear from all of you. Anyway, so now I'd like to invite my guest on. Gwen Shantz is a co-founder of the Brooklyn Grange. And Brooklyn Grange is not your typical farm. It's a self-sustaining organic farm with over 2 acres of rooftop farm cultivated in Brooklyn and Queens. And they've actually sold over 40,000 pounds of vegetables to restaurants, CSAs, and directly to the public. And Gwen is an experienced urban farmer. She's also a freelance writer and an environmental consultant based in Brooklyn. And her background in sustainable food and agriculture led her to be one of the founders of the Bushwick Food Cooperative and a CSA. Gwen, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi,
welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. I've heard so many wonderful things about Brooklyn Grange, but I guess a good place to start would just be for you to tell us a little bit about the farm. When did it start, and you know, how large is it? What do you grow? All those kind of things.
Absolutely. We've got 2 farms now. One of them we started in 2010. It's about 40,000 feet, which is just under 1 acre, and it's on the rooftop of a building in Long Island City, Queens. And our new farm, which we just started this year, is located in Brooklyn, in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And it's a little bit bigger. The roof is 65,000 square feet, and we've got about 45,000 of it under cultivation. So altogether, we're dealing with over 100,000 square feet of rooftop.
Wow. What are the challenges of getting dirt up onto a roof? Like, how do you make that happen? And how does it work? How does it drain? It just seems like there'd be so many complications. Do you actually need what kind of equipment do you need to get all that dirt up there?
Well, yeah, dirt is heavy stuff, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, and gravity is always a challenge when you're dealing with rooftops. And on our first roof, we have over 1 million pounds of soil. And on our new roof, we have nearly 3 million pounds of soil.
Oh, my God.
So it's really heavy stuff. But spread across a large rooftop, we're dealing with more like 40 to 50 pounds per square foot. So it's really not that heavy when it's all spread out. When the way we got the first farm installed was with a crane. We lifted the soil up with about 350 super sacks, which are these huge bags. They hold about a ton of dirt in each one. And then the new roof was actually installed using a blower truck, and they actually blow the soil up onto the roof.
How many stories up are you?
Make like tubes. The first farm is seven. It's on the 7th floor, and the new one is on the 11th or on the 12th floor. Actually.
Oh my God!
So they're pretty high up. We wouldn't want to go too much higher because of wind, but there's actually a lot you can do with a building this size, and our plants are growing beautifully.
Well, then, did you have to do any type of construction to help support that extra weight?
No, we didn't. We're located on two really strong old buildings. They're both pre-World War II construction, which tends to be very solid and overbuilt. A lot of these old buildings were constructed with the use of the roof in mind. So people used to use their roofs for storage or equipment or for just people to use the space. It's a really great place. If you've ever been on a rooftop in New York City, you know it's really quite a lovely thing to visit. So people used to design their buildings with the roofs in mind, and they would make them strong. The buildings that we have today going up tend to be a little underbuilt, so we wouldn't be able to just go in and put a farm on a roof without doing some retrofitting first.
Right. Yeah, I would think so. That's just so much extra weight. Now, what about things like for drainage and things like that? Did you have to install anything special, and does having the soil on the roof help the building with heat retention or cooling or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Any flat roof that you build on already has existing drains to deal with stormwater. So we just use the drains that are already there. There's a layer of drainage mat in the green roof system that we use that helps to keep water from pooling. And then the green roof itself is actually very absorbent. And by green roof, I mean we have a system underneath our soil of a few different layers that protect the roof and also absorb water so that the whole roof is kind of a big rain catch, which is really important for New York City and other cities with stormwater management problems. We really have huge problems when it rains in New York. A lot of the water overflows into our sewer system, and then raw sewage will actually be sent out into our waterways on pretty much any rain event, anything over a tenth of an inch. So it's really important to have green roofs and other sorts of rain-catching green infrastructure in New York City. So we're proud to be playing a positive role there. But then also, like you mentioned, the green roof does insulate the building below, so we're helping to save energy for our neighbors downstairs.
Yeah, I've heard so much about that, about using green roofs, that it's not only great for the garden, and we'll get into that in a moment as well, of course, but just from a sustainable point of view, you know, it's wonderful for rainwater and catching and for the thermal heating and cooling of a building.
Absolutely. The environmental benefits of a project like this are really immeasurable at this point. Aside from all the food that we're producing, the stormwater benefits, the energy savings, And then also we're building a green, kind of a living ecosystem here. We have soil, we have insects, there are birds up here, lots of microorganisms. So we're really kind of promoting biodiversity and living soil here as well.
And you have a view.
And we have a great view of Manhattan.
Great view. So, you know, unlike most urban farms, Brooklyn Grange, you've chosen to be a for-profit farm. Why did you and your partners decide to set it up as a business as opposed to a nonprofit like so many of the urban gardens around?
Well, a big motivation for us here when we started this farm was not only to create the physical farm itself, but also to help to further urban farming in general. As you mentioned, a lot of urban farms and gardens are nonprofits. I would say most of them are. They're funded by the government or by foundations, and they're wonderful and have really important and wide-ranging impacts on the community. But we really wanted to kind of take it to the next step and push urban agriculture in the direction of a fiscally sustainable industry.
Right, and support yourselves. It was, have a living.
Exactly. It's been a tough economy for the past few years, and we knew that no one was going to hire us to do this type of work. We want to be farmers, and we want urban farm jobs here in New York City, so we had to kind of create them for ourselves. We also didn't want to be reliant on grant programs, which are fleeting. So our whole concept really is to create this model that is self-sustaining, that sustains us as farmers and sustains this this beautiful landscape that we've built so that we don't have to worry about it going away.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like a great idea, but it sounds also like it would take a huge amount of capital just to get that started, having to bring all that dirt up there. And, you know, it's more money than starting with, I would think, land that's already on the ground.
How
do you go about
point.
Raising all that money?
Well, unlike most farmers who just kind of move into their farm, we had to actually build our farm first. So we had to raise quite a bit of capital. Our first farm cost in the area of $200,000, which is actually quite cheap for a one-acre green roof. And the reason we were able to get that price so low is because we had a lot of volunteer labor. And we kind of crafted together. It's very DIY. The roof is incredibly safe. We had a structural engineer involved. We had an architect involved. But there was a lot of volunteer and pro bono work going into it. The second farm was quite a bit more expensive for various reasons. And for both of the farms, we sold equity shares. We got some small loans. We did Kickstarter campaigns, and we kind of patched together our funding that way.
Mm-hmm.
But we also, for this new farm, we got a very sizable grant from the New York City Department of Environmental Protection, and it was a stormwater management grant. So the DEP here in New York really takes this stormwater problem very seriously, and so they're putting their money where their mouths are, and they're giving out grants for green roofs like ours. So going forward, I think we're going to hopefully take advantage of those grants more and more for the actual construction of the farms, but then for maintaining the farms, for paying staff, for paying our rents, all the ongoing expenses, we'll be paying for those out of pocket and through the proceeds that we raise through selling our vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the urban farming model that you set up could ever feed New York City or, you know, large cities in general?
No, I don't.
No.
To put it flatly, I don't think that New York will ever be fed by urban farms alone, and I don't think it ever should be fed by urban farms alone. I think there's a lot of potential for the amount of food that can be produced in the city, but I also think it's incredibly important that we maintain our farms and our farmland around the city. The farmers who bring food into New York City are not only bringing us delicious and wholesome food, but they're protecting our watersheds, they're protecting our open spaces against development, and without those farmers, the city would really be a much less healthy place, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important for us to work in tandem with all of the farmers in rural areas and promote them and preserve their culture and their traditions, and also really promote regional food sheds. One of the things we like to do here at the farm is educate people about buying local food and really encourage people to source food that they don't get from us, from other farmers in the area, in New York City, or in New York State, in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut. There's really a wonderful food shed in this area.
And absolutely. Part of it. I couldn't agree with you more, but at the same time, it's very exciting to think that if every building in New York City that was flat on top was a green roof, that it would be so much better for all of the city, for all the reasons we've discussed, for the rainwater protection, for the thermal advances for heating and cooling, for the vegetables could grow.
I couldn't agree more. The benefits are countless, and there's really no downside to what we're doing and to what other green roofers and urban farmers are doing here in New York. So our vision really is to see these farms and other green roofs and ornamental gardens as well go up on every roof in New York City. And I, like you said, I think it's really going to benefit everyone. Not to mention it will be beautiful, which I think is a really important part of all this.
Right, right. Creating nice, it's almost like creating a park on top of every building.
Exactly.
Now, how many types of vegetables do you grow? How much vegetable do you harvest from your garden? Can you share some of that information with us?
Sure. We grow a wide variety of vegetables here. Something that really sets us aside from some of the other commercial urban farmers who are doing hydroponics, they tend to have a much smaller variety of vegetables, and they tend to be leafy greens and tomatoes. And here we've got, in addition to leafy greens and tomatoes, we've got kale and Swiss chard and ground cherries and peppers and lots of perennial herbs and annual herbs as well. Right now I'm looking at some arugula and beet greens, some patty pan squash, habanero peppers, celery. It's really a wide variety. I'd say I can't really count it. I don't have a number for you, unfortunately, but I'd say we have at least 100 different types of plants, edible plants up here. And within those wider types, we have various different varieties. So we probably have about 20 different varieties of tomatoes alone. On the farm in Queens, where I am right now.
Really? Now, do you start your seedlings in the greenhouse and bring them up already as seedlings, or do you direct plant?
A little bit of both. All of our tomatoes and kind of larger, longer-term transplant plants are started indoors in our hoop house, which we put up on the roof, on location, in the springtime, and then we do a lot of direct sowing as well. So we have literally tons of leafy greens that we sow directly into the soil.
Yeah, that's great, because I know, you know, having a greenhouse just can help you with the, you know, the succession planting that I'm sure you need to take advantage of up there.
Yeah. Definitely. We've got such a limited amount of space that we're trying to maximize every square foot and at the same time really protect our soil and make sure that it's not completely overtaxed.
Right, right. Gwen, know what? It's time for us to take a couple-minute break, but when we come back, I want to hear more about, you know, some of the challenges that you come up with and some of the successes that you're finding up there on the roof. Okay, we'll be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Gwen Shantz. She is the co-farmer at the Brook and Grange. And we're just talking about green roofs. And, Gwen, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. So you said you started the farm in 2010 and this new one in just this year? Is that
right? That's
right. Is your farm sustainable?
Financially?
And by sustainable, I mean, you know, of course it's organic, I know that. But is it sustainable, meaning that everyone's able to make a living off of it and get by?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. We've been showing growth over the past three seasons, and technically we've actually been turning a profit, but we didn't really pay our full staff until this year. So this year we have four full-time staff people who are being paid. And then we also rely on a pretty large internship program where college students will work with us through the season and get course credit in return. So we're not a conventional business in terms of making enough money right off the bat to repay all of our investments. But like many small businesses, unlike many small businesses, we are already covering our costs. And within 2 years, we managed to show a profit. So
that's great.
We're kind of an unusual model, but we are showing a lot of success, and we're excited and looking forward to even more growth.
Mm-hmm. And would you say the vegetables are generally affordable by regular, you know, the regular farmers markets, or are you doing more niche? High, you know, more unusual vegetables for high-end restaurants, or are you kind of doing both?
We do both. It's a real mix. We have a CSA program with 40 members, and they get kind of your conventional cucumbers, zucchini, peppers, tomatoes, salad greens kind
mm-hmm.
of mix.
Mm-hmm.
And then for some of the restaurant chefs that we sell to, we've got things like agretti and anise hyssop and Malabar spinach, things that are a little more unusual and command a higher price.
Mm-hmm.
We're just starting to venture into microgreens cultivation, which is a good one in terms of turning a profit, but you don't really grow any pounds of microgreens, and you sell them at a pretty high rate or high price, so we won't be selling those at the farm stand.
Right.
So it is a real mix.
Mm-hmm. So what have been some of your biggest challenges growing up on a roof?
Well, we're dealing with pretty shallow soil. We've only got about 8 or 9 inches in the planting beds. And so we can't really grow things that require very deep soil. But it's kind of amazing what does grow in shallow soil. Tomatoes, peppers, all of the vegetables that I mentioned already grow very well in our shallow soil. But if we wanted to do corn or something like that with a long taproot, we'd probably fail,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
to put it frankly.
Right.
And also,
what about
another big issue
putting
being
some raised
on the roof
beds
is that
up there?
It's pretty windy.
Oh,
uh-huh.
I was going to say, what about putting some raised beds where you could do some double deep areas, so that wouldn't pay either?
Well, we'd have to pay a lot for the soil, but first and foremost, we don't have the load-bearing capacity on the roof to support that amount of soil. We're
mm-hmm.
pretty much, we're growing in as much soil as this roof can bear.
Right, right. And how do you recruit volunteers?
The first year we had to kind of do a little outreach. We reached out to schools and through our friends, word of mouth, but now people just kind of show up. They come to us. I think there's a lot of young people out there who want to be farmers and they want to live in New York, and we provide them the opportunity to do that. There's also a lot of students here in New York City who are studying environmental studies or urban planning or agriculture or food systems, and they want to do internships outdoors and really get a hands-on learning experience, so we can offer that where most people can't.
Right, right. And you partner with other organizations and schools to, like, bring school groups through and do any educational-type workshops?
Yeah, we actually started a nonprofit sister organization called City Growers, and that's an educational program that brings thousands of students up every summer to visit the farm and learn about food and farming and nutrition and ecology. And it's not something that we planned on doing right off the bat, but when we started the farm in 2010, we started getting phone calls and emails from teachers every day who wanted to bring their students up for field trips. And we couldn't say no. We really want these types of education programs to be happening, and we know that the farm is such an amazing learning opportunity. So we started giving tours and working with the teachers and working with the kids, and pretty quickly we realized we had started an education program without really trying.
Right.
And it took a lot of time and resources. So we decided to kind of launch this nonprofit in order to raise grant money so we could hire someone full-time to manage it for us.
Mm-hmm.
So now that's up and running, and it's going great. Almost every day we have school groups up here, and it's really wonderful to see the kids coming through and taking advantage of this really unique learning laboratory.
That's great. I've also saw, I don't know if it was this year or last year, you had a farm-to-table dinner party up there. Did you not?
Yeah, we actually have a number of dinner events every season. Most of them are not open to the public, but occasionally there are public events where you can buy tickets. So people can visit our website to find information about that.
Uh-huh.
It's just brooklyngrangefarm.com.
So if they're not open to the public, do people rent your space? Is that it for private parties?
Exactly. So people will rent the space for private parties, for receptions. We just had a birthday party up here recently, and we've had chefs throw events for their restaurants or for special clients. And we have this amazing rustic banquet table that we built out of reclaimed cedar wood from old water towers. And it seats about 70 people. So we can have pretty sizable dinners up here, and it's really a magnificent experience to sit at this big table and see the sparkling New York City skyline, but also be on a farm and surrounded by living plants and vegetables. Really,
wow, you can see
really
70 people at one table?
Yep, it's a 70-person table. It's about 60 feet long.
Oh, how wonderful. I love that.
Well, you'll have to come visit, Bhavani.
I will. I'll have to be part of a dinner party up there for sure. And are there less mosquitoes and things like that because you're up on a roof with the wind? And
yeah, you know, I've never seen a mosquito up here. And I live in Brooklyn, and I have a backyard there, and it is a mosquito jungle back there this time of year. So, I think because it's so exposed and there's this lovely breeze up here, we don't really get mosquitoes. The breeze can be a challenge, though. It gets quite windy, and we have to our plants actually adapt really quickly to it, and they develop nice thick stems, which is pretty cool. But we have to adapt as well, so we're constantly weighting things down with bricks and tying things up and trying to keep them from blowing away.
Oh yeah, I would think that would be a big problem. Can't have something blowing off a rooftop.
No.
Right.
And our soil as well. We want to make sure that we're maintaining our soil and keeping it from blowing away and eroding.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing that we grapple with. We do a lot of mulching.
Mm-hmm. And what do you do about, I know you're still relatively new, so you haven't been overplanting in one area probably for too long, but are you going to let some areas go fallow and, and plant cover crops, or what's your plan for those?
Yeah, well, we do cover crop in the wintertime, and we leave all of the farm pretty much fallow through 3 or 4 months during the winter, the chance to give the soil a break and also to give ourselves a break. And then in the spring, we come back up and till everything and get it ready for planting. This is the first year where we've really seen the soil. We've seen that our intensive growing has really taken a toll on the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And we do compost heavily, and we bring in a lot of organic matter. So we're constantly fighting that and trying to improve the quality of the soil. I think next year we'll probably be a little bit more strategic about what crops we plant here and what crops we plant at our new farm in Brooklyn, which has relatively new soil. We may be doing all of our tomatoes over there, for example, and then sticking to less intensive crops here in Queens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I know I found that with my garden. I just, I try to do the 3-year rotation and, rotating things around, but I'm still growing stuff everywhere because I don't have that huge a space. So
that much space, yeah.
So I haven't really left, raised beds empty. You know, so I just try to keep putting stuff in. But, you know, at the beginning of the season, it just really seemed like things were going slower this year than I had experienced before. And they finally, you know, took off, but I was adding lots of manure and lots of compost
on
a regular basis.
Yeah, I think that's really the best thing you can do. And luckily here in New York City, we really have no limit to the supply of compost that we can bring in. There are so many people here and so much waste. And we really see it as an important contribution we're making to the city by composting and diverting that waste from the Department of Sanitation's truck system. And we're here in New York City, we're shipping our garbage thousands of miles away sometimes on barges and in trucks. It's really not sustainable. So as much composting as we can do here in the city and recycling that waste into a valuable resource, it's something that we really believe in, and we'd like to continue to do more and more of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a set area, like at the Brooklyn Navy Yard or something, where you're composting down on the ground and letting it decompose before you bring it up? Or you?
We do all of the composting on-site on the roof, but we do work with the Western Queens Compost Initiative. They're a local nonprofit, and they collect compost from farmers markets in the area. And they'll bring us some compost, and they also have ground-level composting operations that we work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think it would be hard to bring up enough compost, like, pre-decomposed, you know? It just would take up so much more space.
Yeah, you know, that's the way we do it, and it's true. We're carrying a lot of water up the stairs when we bring the fresh stuff in. But it breaks down pretty quickly. We have thousands and thousands of worms doing work for us here, and we also use tumblers. We're just about to install a forced air system. It's also known as an AFP system, which will be breaking down our compost much more quickly than the windrows that we use now. So we're always trying to adapt and figure out more efficient ways to operate, and I think improving our composting system is going to be a really big step in the right direction.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, I went to visit up at Stone Barns a few weeks ago, and, you know, it's huge. Like, the composting project and system that they have there is just so immense. And, you know, of course, I've seen Will Allen's projects, you know, and there's just there's so much in composting, and it can be the size of most people's farm, just your compost area.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's such an important thing to be doing. And when you think about it on a larger national level, it's really a drop in the bucket when compared to the amount of compostable waste that's ending up in landfills.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully more and more land will be dedicated to composting.
Absolutely. It is important. And what else? There's something I just wanted to ask you, and it slipped my mind. What projects do you have going on right now? Anything new going on up there? And, oh, I know what I want to ask. Is the farm open for people to come and visit?
Yes. I'll answer the second question first. The farm is open to visitors. On Wednesdays, our farm in Queens is open, from noon to 6. And we have a farm stand where you can buy our vegetables, and you can visit the farm, take pictures, hang out, and then on Thursdays in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, we're also open.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, noon to 6. So
people can just stop by
and visit.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Great. And do people climb up, or is there an elevator?
There's an elevator that goes all the way to the roof in Queens, and then at our location in Brooklyn, there's an elevator to the top floor, and then you have to walk one flight of stairs.
Uh-huh. Okay. So it's handicap accessible in Queens?
Yes.
Great. Great. And is the farmer's market down on the street or up on the roof?
In Queens, it's down in the lobby of the building.
Uh-huh.
And in Brooklyn, it is on the roof.
Okay.
Rooftop farm stand.
Uh-huh. Great. And so what projects do you have going on?
So we've got a few things in the works right now. One of the projects that I'm really excited about is our new mushroom operation. We're growing oyster mushrooms in an indoor location in Brooklyn. And we've just kind of started our pilot phase of that, and we're planning on scaling it up and growing thousands of pounds of mushrooms a year, basically. It's a really great crop, and you can actually grow them in waste products, so coffee grounds, wood shavings from furniture shops,
really?
Things like that. Things that
now
are readily available.
And mushrooms or shiitakes and portobellos, too?
We're starting just with oysters. We'd like to do maitakes as well, which are hen of the woods.
Uh-huh.
We also have some logs that we're growing shiitake mushrooms in, and those are actually outdoors upstairs on the roof in Queens. So we've got a lot of mushrooms that we've got our eye on, but we're just kind of starting with the oysters.
Right.
At this moment.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's great. My friend was growing some shiitakes. I guess they have to be like in the shade, north facing, and right into the. They had this wood wall, and it was just great. They just kept coming.
Prolific.
Yeah,
they're
once you get
crop.
Them started.
Yeah, the only challenge with shiitakes if you're doing them outdoors is that you really want it to be cool outside, not too cold, not freezing, but. They really love 60 to 70 degree weather, and this time of year in New York City, we have more like 80 to 90 to 100 degree weather. So,
right.
In the fall, we'll be getting our shiitakes, but right now they're just kind of dormant.
Uh-huh. How long a growing season are they? Like, can you do them in the fall and, and have enough time for them to grow?
Yeah, and mushrooms grow pretty much overnight. So you just have to shock them, which usually means either dropping the temperature really dramatically or soaking them for about 24 hours. And once you do that, they'll start fruiting pretty much right away. It takes about a year for the mycelium or the mushroom to fully inoculate the substrate, which in the case of shiitakes is a log. So
mm-hmm.
It takes a long time for the mushroom to really fill up that log with all of its material. But once it does, it'll fruit at the drop of a hat. You just have to kind of give it the right moisture and temperature conditions.
Uh-huh. So you could be, you might have only a few months of perfect weather on both sides of the summer and the winter, but
yeah, exactly.
During that time, you can get a lot out of it.
Yep, absolutely.
Good. Good. Well, it sounds like you have a lot going on. And how would people get in touch with you if they wanted to get in touch with you or the farm if they wanted to come by or see what you have or, just find out more information? Do you have a website?
Yeah, I would recommend people visit our website. It's brooklyngrangefarm.com. And people are always welcome to reach out to me. My name's Gwen, and I'm here pretty much every day, 6 days a week. So if you come to the farm, you will find me.
Okay.
And many other people.
And are you at the Queens one or the Brooklyn one or both?
I'm in Queens generally.
Queens. Okay, Gwen. Well, I know I'm going to come visit really soon. And
sounds great.
And I look forward to meeting you in person again. I know we met once. So thank you so much for joining us, and everybody out there who's been listening, I hope you are inspired and look forward to visiting both the Brooklyn Grange and maybe getting involved in a farm yourself. Everyone, have a great rest of the week. I'll be here next week, and just to let you all know that my show time will be changing starting September 6th. You will find me at 10 a.m. on Thursdays at the Progressive Radio Network. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.